CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is UBC Arts on Air. I'm your host, Irene Dell. Each week, we feature the ideas and stories of students and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. Today, Anthony Shelton, director of UBC's world-renowned Museum of Anthropology. And I'm delighted to welcome you here, Anthony. Thank you for coming.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I don't know really where to start. However, I'll start with a touch of history. It's been about 5 years since the new Museum of Anthropology has opened, the renovation and so forth. Can you quickly tell us what's different today than perhaps 10 years ago?
We've moved. I think we had an image of just being a museum of the Northwest Coast, but in fact our collections have always been worldwide. In fact, half of our collections are from Asia and the Pacific. And one of our great kind of moves is to make use of all those collections. So we have the tagline, MOA, a place of world arts and cultures, and that's reflected in the exhibitions we do. We're still committed to collaborative research, but we now look worldwide, and we have facilities which are second to none for research and student teaching.
So this is, was it a doubling of space, perhaps, that much? Or
we increased by just over 50% in 3 years.
That's quite remarkable.
Yes.
Quite remarkable indeed. Was it a project that you yourself anticipated, or was this something that kind of happened as a result of your, administering the museum, seeing what needed improvement and not? Or
yeah, my predecessor, Ruth Phillips, had applied to CFI for funding for new research infrastructure. And in fact, the total project was $56 million, and she'd obtained $17 million of that. So when I came here, we were in a position where we still had quite a lot of funding to obtain. We were also kind of rethinking how we could reconfigure those spaces, and not only research infrastructure, but what we really wanted to do was increase the public gallery size and renovate the existing collection areas too. So the public side was very, very important for me, and that's something that I pushed very strongly for.
Well, whenever I go, I get the sense of more and more people appearing, you know, and coming and enjoying so many of the many things that are there. But I'd like to know, and I wonder if you could take us through the steps of how an exhibition is first of all selected, the timeline involved, and then what happens when the objects begin to arrive at the museum?
Yeah. Let me tell you how ideally it happens. This is a model that we adhere to, and that is that we have a three-year exhibition schedule. So we start planning exhibitions 3 years ahead of time. And one of the major reasons we do that, and that's something that we've just that we started doing in 2010 with the new museum, because we had a larger exhibition space, and so it necessitated that additional funding. So we're open; anybody can come to us with an idea for an exhibition. We generate exhibitions internally. All our curators are busy working on exhibitions. We take exhibitions occasionally from other museums and institutions, and we encourage people to submit their own proposals for consideration. Those proposals go to a committee, and initially that committee is made up of a broad cross-section of people from the museum. So we will have people from education there to talk about programming, people from marketing, communications, finance, our exhibition coordinator, a representative from the curators, myself. And we look at those proposals in relationship to five areas that we try to focus on. So one is Northwest Coast is one of our priorities. Asia is a second priority. We look at exhibitions that are innovative or experimental and haven't been done before, and I think that's a strength of a university museum. We can do that. So that's very, very important, innovative and visual displays that are a little bit unusual and that might turn upside down your ideas of how things are exhibited. Exhibitions that are related to contemporary issues is the other. And fifth, intercultural exhibitions. We're very interested in interculturalism. Not only multiculturalism, but interculturalism, how different cultures overlap and what kind of creative expressions come from that overlapping. So, for example, the exhibition that we did on the Andes, on luminescence, the silver of Peru, was really about interculturalism and the overlapping of different civilizations and how that creates a certain form of art.
Okay, I understand this all theoretically, but now we're sitting around the table. Do you take a vote? How is the decision made, and then what happens after the decision?
By and large, the proposals are read out, and we discuss them, and then there's a kind of a consensus. It always seems to be by consensus. There are certain things. I don't think we've ever turned down an exhibition that our own curators have actually put forward. But it is by consensus. I mean, I myself look for innovation and kind of doing something very, very different because I think it's important that we remain experimental and different from the mainstream.
So if I am proposing an exhibition, do I have to be so detailed as to say approximately how many pieces I think will be in my proposed show?
Not really. You can come to us with a concept to begin with, and then there is an exhibition proposal form in which we have to unpack it. And we can help unpack that, and so people can visualize what it might look like at the meeting before it's accepted.
Let's talk about money. Mm. Exhibitions are expensive, I would presume. And how is all that evaluated?
They are expensive, and it's been one of our challenges. We've been very, very lucky. We apply for government grants. We apply for outside funding, private funding from foundations and from individuals. We've done a lot of work in the last 3 or 4 years with the diplomatic community here. And we work very closely with the consulates. And so we've had major assistance from the Mexican consulate, for example, the Peruvian, Portuguese. That's very important. The Taiwanese trade office, we're working with them on an exhibition on Taiwan, which is on tradition and cosmopolitanism in Taiwan next year. So that's a very, very important source as well. We're creative, and we have kind of already, we look at partnerships, innovative partnerships, and we've been quite successful, I have to say, at kind of raising money for those exhibitions.
Do you work in coordination with other museums? I think of the opera, the Vancouver Opera, I know for a number of years, was always doing, in a sense, co-productions with an opera company in Pittsburgh or maybe Seattle or something. Does MOA do anything similar?
We've tried doing that. I mean, we've tried looking at creating relationships, for example, with museums in the central part of Canada and exchanging exhibitions. And sometimes we've done that. We've exchanged exhibitions with the National Gallery. We've exchanged exhibitions with the Arts Centre at the University of Toronto, more closely to home with Campbell River. We also work with a number of First Nation communities and cultural centres, Musqueam, for example, Alert Bay, UMISTA, the Nisga Museum, Haida Gwaii. So we have no formal ties or systematic ties, but we do work with other institutions quite a lot.
Do you have a fixed number, an ideal number, given a 12-month period, you'd like to have 4 or 6 exhibitions, or it doesn't really work that way?
From a financial point of view and in terms of the number of staff we've got, we've been trying for a while to kind of set it at 4 exhibitions per year. But I have to say, I mean, we've been curating between 6 to 8 exhibitions per year. We're now trying to get that down to 3 or 4 because we feel that that will enable us to do more on the programming side. And it will also, we want to become more integrated with the university's teaching program, and it will give more time to bring in students. And 3 is quite ambitious, I think, for a museum of our size.
Well, now earlier you mentioned approximately 3 years to kind of plan, prepare for an exhibition. But tell me a little bit of what happens when the objects begin to arrive at MOA, and how much time generally is involved in installing the exhibition?
Installation is usually between 3 weeks to 4 weeks. Objects arrive. We have to do condition reports. So our conservation department will look at each individual object, if it's from another institution or from a private collector, prepare a report on each one, noting its condition, and a similar report has to be done at the end of the exhibition before we let those pieces go. Of course, we have to have insurance. We have to do security evaluations and look at the level of security we need for objects. Again, I would say with luminescence, we had 98 national treasures from Peru, and it was one of the first times for many of those. It was the first time they'd left the country, so that was a higher level of security. Sometimes we have to, if we've got objects that are coming from a colder part of the world or a much warmer part of the world, they go into a special room where we adjust the temperatures and humidity over a period of 2 or 3 days until, and so the material can acclimatize before we take it into the gallery. Usually the design is done well ahead of time. The labels are done well ahead of time. But in reality, we're usually working right up until a few days before the exhibition opens. I should say, actually, a few days before the because in most other institutions I've worked at, including national institutions elsewhere, we've been working right up until an hour before opening.
You're sure it's not the theater department now? It's very dramatic. Now, I believe you've got a new exhibition on the 12th of May opening. Can you describe that?
We do. On the 12th of May, we're opening what I think is Canada's first exhibition on, or North America's first exhibition on Portuguese folk art. And it's called Heaven, Hell, and Somewhere in Between, Portuguese Popular Art. UBC has the largest collection in North America of Portuguese popular art, 380 pieces. And what we're doing here, it's a kind of very, you mentioned the theatre department, but in fact, the genre of exhibition is a very theatrical exhibition with huge 12-by-8-foot sheets of rusty metal and plinths and cotton cloth, white unbleached cotton cloth that is suspended. And this material is kind of juxtaposed again in this very theatrical environment. What we're hoping to do is, when people see folk art, certain ideas and prejudices often kind of colour their expectations. What we're trying to do is put it into a completely different context, which is neither art nor artifact, but something magical, something enchanting, to get people to look at it again. And if I think we can seduce people to looking at it again, then perhaps they'll read the text, and the text will actually kind of tell a really complicated story about politics, dictatorship, religious battles, from which all this kind of pieces of popular art actually have emerged.
And will there be a catalogue to accompany this?
There's going to be a monstrous catalogue of about 300 pages. Yes.
Who writes such catalogues? I mean, do you find people in the museum, sort of arena, who do it for us? Or you go to experts outside, or it's a combination?
It's often a combination. The last catalogue on the Kerner collection of European ceramics was written by one of our own curators, Carol Mayer. Heaven, Hell, and Somewhere in Between, the monster catalogue, was written by me.
It should be great.
We hope.
Well, I'm sure. Something I noticed, which is sort of on the MOA website, and I wonder if you could explain it, the Oral History Lab. Mm. What's that, and who provides the oral history?
So a lot of the projects that we do with the lab are with First Nations. One of the things that we do is we transfer media from analog media to digital media and preserve that media. We also provide recording services for First Nations, for example. We've been working with the Barber Learning Centre on a project on oral history recording to create a portable recording unit, actually, that can be taken out to different communities and used. And it's also enables us to share our collections, our archives of the photographs, again, mainly with First Nations, although we do have One Nation project as well.
Can people access it anywhere in the world? Is it open access?
No, because the facilities are physical facilities at the museum.
Okay. It sounds very interesting. And there's also a research library, I believe, right?
There's a research library and an archive. And we also actually have online, so we do have the Reciprocal Research Network, which is an innovative tool which really we developed with three First Nation communities, including Musqueam, of course, and 14 institutions across North America, Canada, Oxford and Cambridge. And really, the RRN gives access to all Northwest Coast collections in all 14 institutions. So you don't have to visit the institutions physically. It's an interactive system, so you can create research groups online. And the idea is that it brings communities together with scholars, together with museum collections.
Sounds marvelous, really marvelous. But I have to ask you, what would be the ideal show that you have not yet put on exhibition?
That's a really difficult question.
All right, two ideal shows.
I guess in terms of ideal, lots of different people will have very, very different ideas of what that they might be. I'm currently kind of thinking, or I've been thinking for a long time, about doing something on water. And what really interests me is actually not to do something scientific on water or something, but to use the work of a philosopher like Bachelard on water and look at the poetics of water and how a show on the poetics of water itself would take you to science and art and other and other areas. So that's one of the things I'm interested in.
I think that's fascinating and timely, my goodness. Mm. I mean, that's all we really are hearing a lot about now in terms of environment and news and other matters. And you begin to think of it in terms of the arts, in terms of literature. It's an astonishing subject.
Yeah, it is.
Frequently, of course, taken for granted.
Yeah.
And nobody, you know, you turn on the faucet and there's the water. You never really realize the significance of it.
And I think that kind of exhibition then allows you to do interdisciplinary exhibition. And a lot of the exhibitions we do, we really push interdisciplinarity. And so water allows you to cross from poetry to science.
I think, pardon me, the verb should be float.
Float, yes.
Okay, thank you. That's it. So if you were educating yourself anew, would you still pursue a track that sees you as a museum director? Or do you really want to conduct an orchestra? Or are you conducting an orchestra?
I think museum directors are probably in the business of conducting.
Opera, not an orchestra.
Sometimes we're not quite sure what genre of music it might be. But it is a process of bringing teams together and negotiating visions, different cultural groups, and creating something. I like to think that whenever possible, we try to create together something that's unimaginable. That's not been done in the past, and that's, I think, what kind of distinguishes us from some other museums.
It's a great answer, but not to my question. I said, if you were re-educating yourself.
You know, if I was re-educating myself, I'd probably become a medical doctor.
Ah, very interesting. Very interesting. What briefly was the route that took you to be a museum director?
I grew up in England under Mrs. Thatcher's premiership. And that was a time when the universities were contracting. And my generation really had to look elsewhere for work. I was really lucky. I became a curator of Latin American collections at the British Museum. And I soon started to work in museums and one day a week at universities, at different universities, teaching museology. So for me, it was really this, the ideal job was actually to teach and to curate. There was a point when I was in Portugal, when I was just had a professorship, I got bored after 3 years, and because I think in a museum, you never know who's going to walk in the door. You never know what possibilities are going to be presented to you or what challenges from day to day. And that I missed. And so UBC offered me the opportunity to actually combine teaching and curatorship, which is a unique experience.
Oh, absolutely. And finally, I have to ask, do you ever envision MOA having, and maybe it does, satellite museums anywhere perhaps in the province? Or is this again a question of funding?
It's a question of funding, but I have a kind of one of the things I'm really interested in, and since coming here 11 years ago, is for me the province culturally is very disarticulated. The collections are in the south of the province. If we're talking about First Nation collections, they're with us, they're with the Museum of Vancouver and the Provincial Museum. What we've seen is a whole openings of cultural centres in First Nation communities, new museums. I'm thinking of Squamish, the O'Dane Centre. In Haida Gwaii, there's a great facility. What I would like to see, I think what we need to do is not actually so. I think we need to work with other institutions to look at how we can create cultural corridors using the institutions that exist in BC. And get these collections traveling across BC. And we need to work together collaboratively to integrate the province more culturally.
I think that's quite visionary. I think that's a really wonderful, wonderful concept. And so I want to thank you, Anthony, for joining us today. Anthony Shelton, director of the UBC Museum of Anthropology. And stay tuned for future broadcasts of UBC Arts on Air with the exciting personalities that make up the Faculty of Arts. Thank you again.
Thank you.